Hi, you're listening to a Pod for Good Media Network podcast. We are a network that provides podcasting production services and a supportive community in which podcasters can thrive. If you're a podcaster local in the Tulsa area, we would love to have your show on the network. If you are interested in starting one, we would love to help you get started. Find us online at podforgoodmedia.com and fill out our Pod With Us form. Happy podcasting.
Episode, I speak with Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. about his efforts to defend tribal sovereignty and promote equity and reconciliation for the Black descendants of freedmen who were formerly enslaved by the Cherokee Nation. But first, the rundown. In local news, newly elected Tulsa Mayor Monroe Nichols signed an executive order Sunday officially designating June 1st as Tulsa Race Massacre Observance Day. It comes just over a month after Greenwood community leaders unveiled a package of reparations proposals they want the city to enact. The mayor has promised to announce more plans on those proposals April 6th. In state news, on Thursday, March 20th, the Oklahoma Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty hosted a Don't Kill for Me vigil during the scheduled execution of Wendell Arden Grissom. It marks Oklahoma's first execution of a death row prisoner in 2025. And in national news, in a rare public rebuke, Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts pushed back against President Donald Trump's call to impeach a federal judge over rulings he doesn't like. As Trump and his allies ramp up their rhetoric, legal scholars warn that the attack on judicial independence could have lasting consequences for American democracy. And those are some of the headlines. This is In Depth with Dion. I'm your host, Dion Osborne, recording from Tulsa's historic Greenwood District. Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr., thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, I'm glad to be with you. Thank you.
I want to say this is maybe our fourth or fifth interview conversation that we've had over the past few years. Mm-hmm. And I want to say thank you for being available and approachable. It's not always easy for journalists, especially Black journalists in Oklahoma, to be able to get access to these conversations and interviews to let our people know what our leaders think and what's happening. And so I really want to get right into it, if that's cool.
Sure. Yeah, and thank you for covering all that you cover.
Hey, we're trying. So first of all, when it comes to sovereignty, that really is the ultimate name of the game, right? Mm-hmm. Everything else boils down to sovereignty. You face attacks on your tribal nation sovereignty from Oklahoma's Governor Kevin Stitt, and more recently from the UKB, the United Ketua Band. Mm-hmm. Can you explain how federal law, treaties, and Supreme Court precedent prove your nation's independent authority and what you're doing to defend tribal sovereignty from these attacks?
Well, tribal sovereignty is a complex subject, but the issue between the UKB and the Cherokee Nation boils down to some simple facts and a timeline. But when people think about tribal sovereignty, the first thing we have to recognize is tribes existed before there was the United States. Our sovereignty, as many tribal traditions teach us, was handed down by the Creator, something that we hold and hold each other together, and then on that basis exercise governing authority. And so much of the last 2.5 centuries has been about determining what that means in the eyes of different beholders. And of course, the most important beholder is the Cherokee people and the Cherokee Nation. Close seconds, the government of the United States and the various court decisions and federal statutes that are handed down. All of that makes for complexity. Anyone who's lived in Oklahoma in the last 4 or 5 years understands that the McGirt case, for example, mm-hmm. Intersects with tribal sovereignty. The UKB is a band of the Cherokee. The Cherokee Nation existed before anyone ever heard of the United States, before anyone ever invented the state of Oklahoma. There was a Cherokee Nation. We've been governing ourselves consistently in an unbroken manner since that time. Treaties with the United States that date back to the founding of the Republic, even treaties that predate the United States, agreements with the British Crown. That's an unbroken chain of legal authority that recognizes the Cherokee Nation. The United Ketua Band was recognized by an act of Congress in one sentence in a law passed in 1946. It recognized them literally as a band of Cherokees.
Okay.
The Cherokee Nation, of course, still existed at that time. Our governing authority had been suppressed quite a bit. The governing authority of lots of tribes had been suppressed quite a bit. That's in the middle of the 20th century. But we never went away. Fast forward to the 21st century, not only are we still here, many people see that we're here in a really powerful way in terms of our governing authority, the recognition of the Cherokee Nation Reservation, which came on the heels of the 2020 McGirt case. All of that is based on a legal foundation, which in turn is based on tribal sovereignty. The issue with the UKB has come up from time to time. The UKB claims to stand in the shoes of the Cherokee Nation or stand alongside us when it comes to these treaties. The UKB, again, this is not even a disputed fact that their recognition was in 1946 and actually took a little longer than that. 1950 is when it was really effectuated, really took effect. The last treaty that the Cherokee Nation signed with the United States that's still in effect today, a treaty you and I have talked about, it's a treaty of 1866, very important treaty for a lot of different reasons. You go backwards from there to 1846 when we had an amendment to a treaty. You go back to the Treaty of New Echota, a removal treaty, which you and I have talked about, that has the delegate to Congress provision. The UKB tries to reach back and put a hook into that and say that's ours too. It doesn't make sense from a timeline perspective, but they have to say that in order to say the next thing they say, which is that we're the Cherokee Nation, this is our reservation, therefore we have the governing authority, or at least the co-governing authority, with the Cherokee Nation. That is factually incorrect. It's legally infirm. No court's ever agreed with it. The Congress of the United States has never recognized that, but a lawyer in the Department of the Interior in the last hours of the Biden administration issued an opinion which said that the UKB had certain rights to put land in trust that has been exaggerated to mean that they have full authority. Mm-hmm. All that's real complicated. I mean, my answer alone to your very simple question has taken here, a few minutes because it's complicated. Yeah. But we're still addressing that, and we have to, because if we don't address it, what it means is everything that the Cherokee people suffered through, our forest removal, rebuilding, the imposition of the state of Oklahoma over our lands, having to rebuild after that, all of that is undercut if this theory that the UKB proposes is true. It's just not true. And it's unfortunate because it's two tribes that are at odds over this. Even more unfortunate that the UKB share the ancestry that the Cherokee Nation has. I mean, we all come from the same people. But the fact of the matter is the UKB was created in 1946 by an act of Congress, which makes it impossible to reach back to a 19th century treaty and say it's theirs. We're still disagreeing over that, and we're going to prevail. I just know we are, because the law's on our side and the facts are on our side.
Well, and on the other side, Governor Stitt has not made it a secret, his disdain, in my opinion, for the existence of the Cherokee Nation and other tribal nations whose reservation boundaries reside within the, quote-unquote, state of Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. He's called you the biggest threat.
Yes.
To Oklahoma's sovereignty, which
right.
I think was hell of ironic and hypocritical to use that word.
Right.
What are your thoughts?
Well, it's been that way since he took office, and it became even more so when he tried to assert his will on the historic gaming compact. And then during COVID, there were some difficulties in terms of our authority, his authority, public health, that sort of thing. The McGirt case, though, put it really in the forefront. The McGirt case, which reaffirmed tribal sovereignty in terms of the geographic reach, the 7,000-mile Cherokee Nation Reservation, the Chickasaw Reservation, Choctaw Reservation, Seminole Reservation, and Muscogee Creek Nation, which, of course, figures prominently in here in the Tulsa area, I should say, along with the Cherokee Nation Reservation. Governor Stitt views sovereignty I suppose like he views business transactions, which is a zero-sum game. If somebody's getting more, that must mean somebody's getting less. That's not the world that I live in, and it's not, that may be some theoretical world that drives him to say tribes just shouldn't exist in the 21st century. It's taking away from state sovereignty. The world I live in works like this. We have the sovereign authority to govern, which we use to a lot of good. I mean, we harness resources that only a sovereign Indian nation can harness for things like roads and bridges, to help public schools, to help build parks, to build health systems, to create jobs. Yes, to govern, which includes public safety. It includes asserting our criminal jurisdiction, which is in the media a lot. What that really means is there's another layer of not only competent, but some of the best law enforcement around in terms of the Cherokee Nation Marshal Service that's helping wrap this blanket of protection around victims, hold people accountable, have a system that's fair, and then have a system of crime and punishment that doesn't, at least we hope, doesn't chew up people and spit them out, that there's some path through rehabilitation. That's all good. And that means it doesn't come at somebody's expense. That means it adds. And so one of the comments you made did bring up to my mind how offensive Governor Stitt's comment was, that it's coming at the expense of state sovereignty, given how the state of Oklahoma was created and imposed upon tribal lands in which it suppressed tribal sovereignty. But what I think of more is that I live in a world in which governments working together or doing some positive things because the people want it alongside each other is good. It's not bad. It's not a zero-sum game in my experience. He and I view the world in radically different ways. His is transactional, a zero-sum game. Mine is collaborative. What do the people want? They want healthcare. They want housing. They want public safety. They want the world tomorrow to be better than it was yesterday. They want their kids to have a better community to live in. I'm not saying he doesn't want those things. He just doesn't see a way that we figure into that. We are a chapter in history that ought to just stay there, I think, for Governor Stitt. One last thing. People like Governor Stitt and people like me come and go. We're elected officials. And so he's not always going to be governor. There's a great many leaders in this state, including the state legislature, including in his own executive branch, who want to work together. That's good news for Oklahomans. That means that eventually other perspectives will come to bear, and we'll get back to what we were doing for decades before Governor Stitt took office, which is increasingly work together. I'm an optimist.
I hear you. I mean, the tribes collectively contribute billions to this state's economy. You opened up summer food program for vulnerable children, not just Cherokee children, but anyone within the reservation boundaries when Stitt closed it off, when Stitt refused to accept that federal funding. And now, you know, the federal branch is kind of cutting federal funding that is impacting the Cherokee Nation and the state of Oklahoma. And so I feel like your leadership styles, and, you know, I wrote this in an article, I want to say a couple years ago, you have two completely vastly different leadership styles. And I feel like part of that is, you know, different environments around which you were raised, right? You know, Stitt comes from, as you said, a business background where he was actually chastised for his business practices in several states. And that seems to be the approach that he's taken to governing. But unlike state and federal leaders, you've pursued a different vision for the Cherokee Nation. You've expanded resources and programs. You've ensured a raise in wages and housing developments. You've apologized for the Cherokee Nation's past enslavement and pursued policies to expand equity and representation. Why?
Well, it's what I thought I was elected to do. And it's not just me. This is a philosophy, this idea that the government of the Cherokee Nation ought to be serving the people that it represents and mm-hmm. helping our friends and neighbors. That's something that's shared across leadership and then across successive leaders. For me personally, my father, who's the greatest public servant I've ever known, always acted, and he was elected official, campaigned, and served in office in a way that showed me that government is supposed to be a positive impact in people's lives, that people that don't have a voice ought to have a government that has their back, that there ought to be a level playing field, which sometimes means raising people up and doing some additional measure of investment for people or communities that are behind and recognizing that. That's what he taught me and my wife, who is just somebody that's, I can only describe as the most important influence in my life, believe that government ought to listen to people, and that the people who are least able to protect themselves and to pick themselves up when they're knocked down ought to have people that are there to help them. And if the government won't do it, somebody ought to tell the government they ought to do it. And then that took different forms. And when she and I were younger, in terms of advocacy. So all of that's told me, we got to listen to the people and give the people what they say they want. And what Cherokee people say they want is funding for education, housing for elders, a path to home ownership for people who are young and want to stay in communities, healthcare that doesn't bankrupt people, that you can live your lives and everybody has an equal shot at accessing healthcare and becoming well, if they to the greatest extent possible. So maybe it's upbringing, maybe it's what I've seen in my wife and my father and a lot of other leaders that has shaped me, but it does seem to me that the Cherokee Nation doesn't have unlimited resources, but we've got a lot. And if we've got a lot of resources, we ought to put them into communities and into people in the form of programs, services that will make the future better. And you can only do that if you make these long-term investments, I think, in healthcare and education, improving housing conditions, and create a safety net for when people fall down. I mean, my goodness, when people literally fell down during our forced removal, we almost instinctively picked them up. I mean, I think it's a very human characteristic, but it's certainly part of our culture. We're all in it together. We were all in it together during those difficult times. We need to be all in it together now. And that takes the form of government, which is what we do when we work together. That's all government is working together. That's the way I see the world. Not everybody sees it that way. And I think there's a harshness sometimes to the politics today. And that harshness translates into public policy, and that public policy is translating at times into things that hurt people that I care about, people that need Medicaid, people that need rental assistance and housing, people who aren't going to get a shot to go to college unless there's some dollars there to help them. I could go on and on, but a lot of these programs that I think are a bit in the crosshairs right now, it concerns me that there's this harshness to public policy. But it's not harsh at the Cherokee Nation. We're thankfully still a very caring environment, and we think we've all got a stake in each other's welfare. That's the way we operate.
Would you ever run for Oklahoma governor?
Would I ever run for Oklahoma governor? Well, this is a state that's proven, I think, challenging for those ideas to take root and be successful electorally. And that's what, if you're going to run, you got to run to win. I do think that we need people in this state, and I don't know if it's me, that can speak to what people in this state expect from their government. And they've got to expect more. They just have to. I mean, we spend less on public education in the state of Oklahoma today than we did a decade ago. Mm. I think if you talk to most Oklahomans about that, they'd say, I love my public school. I want my public school to do better. And if you talk to them about that statistic, that we spend less today than we did a decade ago, I think they wouldn't like it. I think they would respond to somebody campaigning on that. There's a lot of other issues, though, that divide us. And so I've seen a lot of divide and conquer in this state. I've seen a lot of sort of wedge issues that keep people from thinking about public safety, public education, investing for the common good. And then they start thinking about us versus them. Who should I be afraid of? Who should I be scared of? Who should I blame for problems that I'm seeing? That politics isn't my politics. And if that's winning politics in the state of Oklahoma, I probably couldn't win. But I'm an optimist, and I think people who think the way that many of us think, myself included, could win. I don't know that you asked me a simple question, and I gave you another long-winded answer. But whoever runs for governor in the future, I hope they embrace that philosophy.
I think it just shows that you care about how you respond and you want to give thought to your responses, and I appreciate that. And I kind of agree with you. I think, and I just wanted to throw that out there, really, but I think a lot of times we assume what's not possible because we haven't had people who were authentic when what they believed in and carrying that into their campaign. And so I would love to see that one day. And if you ever do decide to run, definitely let me know.
I'll try to break the news
here. Give me the heads up. I want to move on to kind of an update. Mm-hmm. For people who don't know, you mentioned it, but the Treaty of New Echota, talk about why that's so important. Talk about the pain that came with that mm-hmm. for the Cherokee people and what efforts you're still taking place to try and turn that into a reality.
Yeah, and just to add, just give some historic context here, the Treaty of New Echota, 1835. It's 1835 in the United States. Andrew Jackson has cast the die that the native peoples of the southeast part of the United States are going to be removed, including the Cherokee Nation. There needed to be, because of the tradition and legal standards in the United States, even during those times, was there needed to be a negotiated removal. But, of course, a negotiated removal in which the United States was more powerful, was asserting its will, was using governments like the state of Georgia to sort of impose injury on us until we just were going to give in. Well, we stood strong, but what happened was a minority faction of the Cherokee Nation signs the Treaty of New Echota. That treaty ends up being the instrument that forcibly removes us after the Indian Removal Act. There's a lot of bad stuff in that treaty. There's a lot of things in that treaty that remind us the injury that was imposed, that we were to be rounded up, marched across the United States into land we'd never seen before, and that was going to be our new homeland. There's one sentence in there that we held out for, and it said that the Cherokee Nation shall have a delegate in the United States House of Representatives when Congress makes provision for the same. So in 2019, I appointed Kim Teehee to the position of delegate to Congress. We've been knocking on the door at Congress ever since. Now, if you and I did interview, I think, probably 4 or 5 years ago on this subject. I was probably more optimistic and more naive then. What I should say is I'm more naive then. I've been to Congress many times since then. And what I've learned is there is a recognition on the part of the Congress. And in November 2022, I testified in front of the Rules Committee and helped, I wasn't the only one, but I helped lay this legal and factual foundation in the congressional record that I think is irrefutable, which is Congress made a promise. Congress needs to keep a promise. No one in the House of Representatives or the Senate, for that matter, has said, Chief, you're wrong. The treaty's expired. It doesn't mean that. But they also haven't implemented this provision. And we pushed and pushed. Part of it's because we've seen a lot of dysfunction in the Congress over the last 4 or 5 years. I mean, Congress is doing good to hang on to one leader because there's division. Congress is doing good to keep the lights on because there's been a lot of government shutdowns, and we're on the cusp of one actually right now. And so that's part of the reason I think we haven't seen progress. The other part of the reason we haven't seen progress is that for many members of Congress, it's still an obscure issue. It's still not top of mind. The general idea of keeping a promise is important, but the very specific idea of keeping a promise that seats a Cherokee in the House of Representatives as a delegate, which is unprecedented, is not something that they seem to be collectively moved to do. But we're not giving up. We've got some allies in Congress. We've got some friends. Congressman Tom Cole from the state of Oklahoma, the 5th District, is a friend and an ally. I'm convinced of this. 4 years ago, I was a little more naive. I'm not as naive as I was. It's going to take more time. It may take more time than I've got. Now, I've only got a couple of years left, but I'm not going to quit fighting, and I'm not going to quit or abandon this idea that the United States is a better country when she keeps her word. And that's, I think, plain and simple. If they're going to keep their word in a way that is very powerful, it would be keeping their word as to this sentence in this treaty, because this is about more than one sentence in one treaty. It's about every sentence in every treaty. Mm-hmm. And so it can be the beginning of an era in which more treaty rights are asserted and won. But we just got to keep pushing.
Well, and, you know, when it comes to asserting treaty rights and honoring those, you've taken steps to make sure that the Cherokee Nation stands by what it says on paper when it came to the Cherokee Freedmen and recognizing. The Cherokee Nation is the only tribal nation of the so-called 5 civilized tribes mm-hmm. that has fully embraced their freedmen into the tribe, citizenship, benefits, rights. I know for me, my granny was born in Bartlesville, and I had never lived in Oklahoma until my parents split up. My mom wanted to move down here when I was like 11 years old. Mm-hmm. I did not know I had any ties to Oklahoma. I knew my granny was born here, but she never talked about it. It was through journalism, and I'm like you. When I see you know, I like to stick up for the least of these, and you know, I like to support marginalized people wherever they may be and whoever they may be, whatever they may look like. And so I was just covering the story of the freedmen, and over time I started to realize that there were some facts about my granny's history that were kind of similar to some other stories that I've been covering. And I had no idea that my granny is actually a freedman descendant. And so I'm right now in the process of, you know, getting her documents and all these things, trying to help my family out and go through all of that. But I do feel a little bit lucky in a way that it's come at a time, like me kind of learning my history has come at a time where Cherokee freedmen are being embraced. Yeah. You know, this is the time to really learn your roots. And there's something about, there's some kind of quiet confidence that comes with knowing where you come from.
Yeah.
You know, regardless of the struggles that they went through, they got through it, right? And that's kind of what I think about my ancestors, is how they survived all these things. Talk a little bit about the time over the last couple of years that you have spent working with the tribe, working with freedmen in the tribe to come up with these equitable policies to try and bring some, to try and bring some equity and shared understanding and a shared family vision for the Cherokee Nation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think it's one of the most important things we've ever done. I'm talking about Cherokee people have ever done, is to face our history together, to face it in a way that's unvarnished, unfiltered, not whitewashed, recognize and try to reconcile what we did with where we are now. And I can tell you the albatross that was denying citizenship and identity of freedmen, removing that collectively from our shoulders, has been liberating for the Cherokee people. Mm-hmm. It's been something that's ushered in an era that just should continue and continue, of us being a bigger tribe, a stronger tribe, a tribe that's not as burdened, and I'll talk a little bit about how we're still burdened, but not as burdened by what we did. And what we did, for those who may be unfamiliar, is we enslaved Black people in the 19th century, and we started doing it in the early part of the 19th century. We were situated geographically in the southern part of the United States, and that's not an excuse, but it gives people geographic mm-hmm. context and also historic context. We helped build our economy at that time, pre-removal, on the backs of slave labor. Slaves went on the Trail of Tears as slaves, as property. You can look at records, and there's the records of people, and then there's the records of property. Right. And slaves, as people know about slavery in this country and around the world, were considered property. After removal, we continued to rebuild, or we started to rebuild, and we rebuilt in part on the backs of slave labor. It wouldn't be till 1866, following the Civil War, that we signed a treaty saying that freedmen, freed slaves, and their descendants shall have all the rights of native Cherokees. And then we would spend the next century and a half fighting that, suppressing that, until the first quarter of the 21st century, which we're in now, with a court decision, 2017, when the federal judge told us what that meant. It meant freedom and equality. We had our own Supreme Court of the Cherokee Nation interpret that and give it deeper meaning, what it really means, which is freedom and equality without reservation, without exception. So what we've tried to do since I've taken office is build on that. I took office in 2019, and it did seem to us that, look, we got to embrace the spirit. It's not enough just to say, okay, fine, that's what the treaty says. It was the court said, we'll do the minimal, what it says on paper. We got to embrace it all. Part of what we've done, and I think this is one of the most important things we've done, is we assembled a committee of freedmen descendants to ask them a question. How can we tell your story? How can we tell it through art, through history, through community engagement? Melissa Payne, who is our liaison to the freedmen community, a Cherokee citizen of freedmen descent, does a wonderful job helping us go into communities that we haven't been in before historically, including North Tulsa. Our Secretary of State, Shella Boland, a freedmen descendant, brilliant lady, does such a great job. What we've been able to do is to take this idea that freedmen ought to tell their own story and we ought to listen to it, is we've got a beautiful exhibit that was in our museum that really confronted you, whether you're freedmen or non-freedmen. You look at the names of these folks that were included your ancestors. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about you. And I'm right. talking about people who also are descending.
Right.
You can see these names, and we got to look at them together. And we know that we're all on these lists that the government made. And it starts to remind us that we have this shared history. We enslaved people, but we have this shared history, and we've got an opportunity, not just an obligation, an opportunity to make this century a century of equality. We're embracing our history, embracing each other. Part of that is by asking Friedman to tell the story. Got an executive order on equality because we've got work to do. It's not enough just to say freedmen are equal citizens. If they come in to get services or exercise their rights, yeah, they get to do it. We got to take steps as programs to, again, go into communities and talk about programs and services, talk about something you're dealing with right now, which is how do I take that path from my family story to documented ancestry to a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. You're on that journey right now. That's a difficult journey. It's a difficult journey for freedmen descendants often because they've got to go back to the turn of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to do that. I had to ask my father, you know, not literally, but when I was a kid, he had his card. I become a citizen. Go down and take and right. and you and perhaps and others who are freedmen descendants have to go way back in a deep dive. Can we assist with that? We should assist with that. That's part of the effort, is taking some affirmative steps, recognizing that a people who were suppressed for a century and a half cannot be expected to fully be able to exercise their rights as citizens, the opportunities that citizenship brings and the obligations that citizenship brings, unless the government of the Cherokee Nation recognizes that one of the ways we reconcile is to go into communities and say, how can we help? And it was just a few weeks ago, we were at the Greenwood Cultural Center with a contractors fair and an employment fair. That's a small thing, but those small things over and over again, the art competition for young freedmen citizens that we have, the monument that we are going to build mm-hmm. in Tahlequah to the freedmen struggle to emancipation, recognizing that we enslaved other people and then what happened next. Those things in the totality, I think, will link us together. People, young Cherokees, whether they're freedmen or not, seeing Shelley Boland as the Secretary of State of the Cherokee Nation makes them see that we're all in it together. Mm-hmm. Marilyn Mann, who's on our Environmental Protection Commission, a great champion of the rights of freedmen, she serving in the government. That says something, I hope, about the Cherokee people. It's not all about me, but the opportunity that I had to go before a Senate committee and a House committee and say, the Cherokee Nation enslaved black people, it was wrong, we apologize, and here's what we're doing. Laying that all out, I think it has a bit of a cleansing quality mm-hmm. for this stain that we all have from slavery. I think it's one of the most important things that we are doing, but we got to keep doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, this country's been struggling with it for yeah. over two centuries. We're going to struggle with it as Cherokees for a period of, I don't know how long, but we'll struggle with it and get buried by it if we don't own it and try to do something about it to atone. So that's where we are.
And I really respect that about your leadership because, you know, my approach kind of to calling things out has always been the shame approach, right? I mean...
Yeah,
at least in the short term.
I've done that myself a few times.
Okay, you know, maybe in your younger advocate days, you know, like it can have some short-term benefits, but mm-hmm. ultimately, even when you achieve that short-term mm-hmm. goal, the culture shift didn't happen.
Yeah.
And so leading by example is something I've watched you do over the years that I've been following you. And, you know, I think that's powerful. I think that's powerful. You know, you are not someone who... You only speak for the Cherokee Nation. You don't try and speak for other nations. You don't try and tell other nations what to do, mm-hmm. but you try and show what's possible and show what should be done.
Right.
And I really respect that for you because I know that it couldn't have been easy. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you had lots of people from inside and outside telling you different things. Mm-hmm. And like you say, it takes time for that culture shift to take place. But I will say being in the Greenwood Cultural Center during the Black History Month celebration, mm-hmm. yeah.
it really felt like this is what, you know, this is what community looks like, you know? And, you know, I've never, like, that was one of the most places I felt at home in this state.
Good.
You know, is when I'm, you know, at the very southern boundary, maybe, of the Cherokee Nation, but it's still a Cherokee Nation.
Still in, yeah.
And it's actually inspired me to, you know, one day purchase a home here.
Great.
And so, you know, I'm looking to have some long-term roots and trying to bring some family down here to, you know, to really help create, be part of this community. And so I appreciate you just for sure. Who you are and what you do.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Now, I have one final question for you. And I mean, it's a hard one for a lot of us to figure out right now.
Uh-huh.
You lead a nation that has survived genocidal European aggression, disease, a death march, and land theft. How do you hold on to hope, especially at times right now, for a better future?
Well, part of it is what our ancestors did in the face of those things and in the wake of those things. I mean, it's inspiring. And when I get a chance to talk, particularly to young Cherokees, you know, and if I'm talking about history, the Trail of Tears, the forced death march that you talked about, is important. There's two things that I tell them that I think are more important in terms of what it builds in our national character and why you can be hopeful on that basis. One is, we didn't simply get rounded up one day and marched. We resisted. And what I want them to know is how we resisted. We didn't go to war. We didn't decide violence was how we would reconcile this problem. We leaned into diplomacy, democracy, and institutions of government based on the rule of law, a government of laws, not men. We leaned into that, took the United States to its own court and beat them. Did we ultimately have to yield to, you know, the bayonets, the army marching us into stockades? We did, but that built something in our national character, what happened before. And I want them to know that, because in their own lives, they may have a tendency, in part through generational trauma, which is real, to give in to violence in their own lives, or to think that everything should be combative. Sometimes it has to be, but not always. The other thing I wanted to know is what happened after we were knocked down, our ancestors. We got back up, and we got back up by investing in each other. That's the other thing I want them to know. How'd we do it? When most of the money we had left, we put into public education. The rest of it we put into rebuilding that democracy, that Cherokee democracy, which stands as one of the oldest democracies still around. And democracy's fragile. It's still around. We invested in that. We invested back into institutions that upheld the rule of law. I want them to know that that's how their ancestors survived. It wasn't just individual, every man for himself. It was, we got to survive. We owe something to each other. Let's stick together. I want them to think about that, because we live in a day and age in which this every man for himself philosophy is just crammed down our throats, and it often takes the form of government governing in a way that I don't think is healthy for the country. So how, in the face of all those atrocities, do we stay hopeful? And we don't forget it. We don't let people forget it. But we also look at the whole story, and the whole story is much more than a people who were knocked down, who were subject to the near termination or extermination. They were a people that fought back. We fought back with our brains. They were a people that rebuilt. We rebuilt by hanging on to each other. If we can do that then, what we can do now, even though it's an uncertain time right now, what we can do now in this century is going to be the greatest Cherokee century if we do those things. And that's why I think you can be hopeful if you're a Cherokee, even thinking about those dark chapters.
Well, that's a whole sermon. I hope people were listening. And again, thank you so much, Chief Hoskin, for coming on the podcast.
I appreciate you, sir. Thank you.
For this week's Community Spotlight, I spoke with Ileana Pacheco, a U.S. citizen and nurse who says she was detained and racially profiled by ICE officials while leaving the Puerto Rican airport in San Juan. She told me when she demanded to know why she was questioned, an ICE agent told her, quote, she fit the description of someone who looks undocumented. Check out what she had to say.
It was in the morning. I didn't see any other colored person that was being detained, at least from my end. I go to the ICE agent, the other lady, and I was like, excuse me. I was like, why are we being detained. I'm like, what's the point of being detained? He won't answer my question. Can you please answer my question? Why are we being detained? She said, because you fit the description. I'm like, what description? She said, you fit the description of someone who's undocumented. And it's just honestly just reliving that. It was like, fit the description of someone who's undocumented? Like, is this really how like most Hispanics or just any immigrant in general is feeling in this country? Like, I had so many text messages after making that status. I made that status on Facebook to bring awareness.
This week on Mic Up, I went to TikTok to learn what Oklahomans have to say about possible DOGE cuts and how they could impact the National Weather Center based in Norman, Oklahoma, as we begin severe weather season. See what they had to say.
Unfortunately, we have news of more potential cuts coming to NOAA, and this one is even more consequential. These two buildings are located in College Park, Maryland. It's NSEP and the Weather Prediction Center, WPC. As I've said before, the most critical aspect of NOAA is the data, and all that data is housed at that NSEP building. That building is 200,000 square feet, and it's designed that way on purpose because it houses these supercomputers that hold all of the data. Believe me, every single square inch of that building is being used. Why does it matter? Well, these supercomputers are what runs these weather models we use every day, like the GFS, the HER, the NAM, the HREF, etc. If something were to happen to those supercomputers, like something were to break or there was some transition in moving to a new building, then you're talking about not having any model data for an indefinite period of time. These forecast models are the number one tool used by any weather entity, like your weather app, your National Weather Service forecast, any TV, any social media influencer, etc. Every single person depends on this data. And if you had a time where high resolution models were not available, then you would not be able to predict severe weather in advance with any kind of skill. Another building that may close is the Radar Operations Center in Norman, Oklahoma, which is responsible for repairing and maintaining Doppler radar. The impact of that is self-explanatory. If you don't have Doppler radar, you can't see storms coming, and therefore that puts people in danger. Now, none of this is actually official at this point, but even if it's a case of simply moving to a new building, it's hard to imagine this going smoothly. On most days, you probably won't feel impacts because the weather is very boring. It doesn't matter, but you will feel this on days where it matters the most. Because imagine what happens if a major hurricane is poised to strike the U.S., but we don't have Hurricane Hunter data. Imagine if this spring there is a tornado outbreak and the high resolution models were not working, radars were going down, and only half the people were watching the sky. I strongly encourage you to share this video widely and to contact your representatives to let them know how serious this issue is. This puts all Americans at risk, and any savings from these cuts will immediately be negated by billions of dollars of additional economic losses, and more importantly, loss of life. Yes, people's lives are at stake.
That's all for now. Watch In Depth with Dion on YouTube, on Patreon for exclusive and behind-the-scenes content, or listen anywhere you get your podcasts. This podcast is presented by the Black Wall Street Times. Special thanks to our producer, Jesse Ulrich. I'm your host, Dion Osborne. Stay woke.